Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Paul Johnson. He's a West Coast-based independent filmmaker and broadcast journalist. He's been making films on many topics for more than two decades. He's a former White House reporter for Canadian television and Beijing correspondent. He's also director of Last of the Ancient Red Rainforests, The Emotional Connection to Trees, a new feature film. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being in the program.
Well, thank you very much. And it's a great pleasure to be interviewed by you. I've been following your work and enjoying it for many years. So this is a big pleasure for me.
Well, thank you so much. So introduce people, if you can, to this film. Which rainforests are you talking about? Just tell us all about it.
Well, most people who paid any attention to the state of the world's forests are aware of the story of what's been happening to rainforests. And, you know, rainforests are really persuasive because they're charismatic ecosystems. They are lush. They usually, depending on where they are, have a tremendous abundance of flora and fauna. And we know they play a critical role in stabilizing all life on planet Earth. In recent years, most of the attention and most of the time when people think of a rainforest, the Amazon is usually the first one that comes to mind. And of course, there are many reasons for that are valid. And the status of the Amazon rainforest is something that we all need to be concerned about. We think of other rainforests. We think of the Congo Basin in Africa. We think of the rainforests that are in Southeast Asia. But actually, the most productive rainforest in the world, the most productive kind of rainforest, is one that North Americans, for instance, don't often think about, and that is our coastal temperate rainforest. Temperate rainforest is, it's just really what it sounds. It's a forest that exists in a place that is not tropical, that's not Arctic. It's kind of in the middle. It's temperate, and it's a rainforest. It is built around getting a tremendous amount of moisture, in the case of this forest, coming off of the Pacific Ocean. And temperate rainforests, different from tropical rainforests, actually have the ability to generate more biomass per acre than any other kind of forest in the world. They're actually the most productive forests if you look at them in that one dimension. Now, there are things that are different that are going on in tropical rainforests that make them exceptional, but temperate rainforests have this ability to grow incredibly huge trees and to develop ecosystems around those trees, which in many cases can grow to be very, very old, much older than trees than we would see in a typical tropical rainforest system. So our temperate rainforest, if you want to think geographically about it, it was at a pre-European contact setting, was absolutely vast in scope. It started north of about San Francisco, where it was dominated by a lot of the majestic redwoods. Sadly, most are gone. And it moved up the coast and up to Oregon, Washington State, British Columbia, and the British Columbia coastline, being so vast, contained most of it. And then that forest continues north and it goes up and it kind of peters out in Alaska as the latitudes make things colder. Probably the most productive zone of the coastal temperate rainforest was and has been in British Columbia, where I'm talking to you from now, here in Vancouver. And there are some reasons for that. And it mostly, again, has to do with the climate, that the latitudes here are still low enough that there's enough warmth to allow for this kind of fecundity in the forest. And there's a tremendous amount of moisture coming off of the Pacific. The coastal temperate rainforest is also unique in as much as it really, if you look at a map of it, it really hugs very closely the western edge of North America. In most cases, it's only about maybe 35 to 75 miles wide. And in the region where I'm in, it basically peters out completely once you go east of the Cascade Mountains, which stretch from Northern California up here into British Columbia. And it's a tremendous and beautiful ecosystem that's inspired a lot of people to do a lot of different work, including me, to make this film and tell the gripping and emotional story of what has happened to it.
So before we go on, there's, you were mentioning about it being a narrow strip, and where I live, the strip is especially narrow because the mountains are maybe 2 miles from the ocean, and so maybe 3 miles from the ocean. And so if you go, and I am in the midst of that California, or the northern end of the California Redwoods, and if you go 10 miles east, you're in a ponderosa pine forest.
Yes.
Well, actually, that's not true. You go 10 miles east, and it's probably tan oak Doug fir. Another 10 miles east, and it's ponderosa pine. So it can go very, very quickly as soon as the rain disappears. As soon as the rain and fog disappears. We can't leave fog off, because fog is incredibly important for this.
Yes, fog and the ocean mists and the moisture rolling off the ocean is a huge part of that. And you'll see that in my film, Last of the Ancient Rainforests, in some of the opening scenes. You see this. It's in the middle of summer when I shot that. It's actually in August. It had been dry for a very long time. And we were down shooting near Port Renfrew, B.C., and there's this permanent fog bank that's lingering off of the coast there. And depending on the winds, this moisture is rolling in, and it's keeping the entire area wet and moist. And this is another part of what makes these forests so special and unique, and what enables them in many cases to become truly ancient ecosystems, is that you have very little fire. In some places, especially at higher elevations, you have actually no known history of fire, because it stays wet year round. Even if you're in a drought situation, you often have enough snow melt coming down that keeps things in a state where you do not have the kind of land clearing forest fires that you see very frequently just east of the mountains. And this enables trees to become truly ancient. And when I say ancient, I'm talking trees that are more than 1,500, 2,000 years old in the case of some of the yellow cedars that we were talking about there. And this isn't somebody's speculation. These are trees where people did core samples and counted the rings. And these trees go back two millennia. It is really mind-boggling.
So earlier you said that the temperate rainforests are one of the things they do is they're one of the most productive, or maybe the most productive forest in terms of biomass. And then you talked about the size of the trees. And before we turned on the recorder, you and I were discussing something that I just recently learned, which is that redwood trees were not originally, nowadays redwoods are known as being the tallest trees in the world, but that was not true 300 years ago. So can you talk just a tiny bit about that?
Well, I mean, when you think about where the redwoods, which most people would say are probably the biggest trees that we have in North America, the tallest trees that we have, that's probably been the case in terms of what people have been able to see and measure. But Douglas firs and Sitka spruces can also grow to stupendous heights. And I mean, had we not cut down most of the oldest and biggest Doug firs and spruces up here in the Canadian and the Washington State part of the coastal temperate rainforest, probably the richest part, is it possible that we actually had trees of those type that were taller than redwoods? I think it's very likely. One of the things that was going on even up until the late 80s is that you had big tree hunters These were guys who were motivated just to go out into the forest of British Columbia and look for really big trees. And one of them, a guy called Randy Stoltman, who was kind of the leader in the latest wave of forest conservation in British Columbia, he just started poking around on the west coast of Vancouver Island in some of the valleys that had not been clear cut there yet. And he was finding incredibly tall trees. I think Randy found the tallest Sitka spruce ever found in Canada, well north of 300 feet. And I mean, this is actually astonishing to think about. As mapped and as satellite scrutinized as our planet Earth is, and particularly these places where industrial logging has been going on, there are still pockets of trees out there where we actually don't know how tall some of them are. It's possible we still have some huge ancient giants out there. And I'll talk a little bit more about this later, how there are still finds that are going on, which is really awe-inspiring and positive, given how much industrial clear-cutting has been going on up there. So yeah, we actually could have some of the tallest trees in North America up here. How many of them are left? That's a huge question. But you may also have some redwoods down there that are taller than anybody knows. I don't know exactly the state of scrutinizing your forests down there. They probably would know, but who knows?
How big around would a really, really tall Sitka spruce be, either diameter or circumference?
Well, you'll see in Last of the Ancient Rainforest, one of the chapters of the film, if you will, is the story of Big Lonely Doug, which is a Douglas fir tree. And it has an interesting story because it's one of these stories that's in this sweet climactic zone where trees could grow massive and old. And about 15 years ago, there was a logger who was at the end of his career, and he was a logging scout, a man named Dennis Cronin. And he had gone out to scout out a new cut block for one of the companies that was going to come and cut those trees down. And there were all big trees in there. And there was one that really blew his mind. And this is a guy who'd been working in the forests there for 30 years. And he said, no, I don't think this tree should be cut down. And he marked it with a certain color of flagging tape, green, and they didn't cut it down. That tree is 12 meters in circumference. And I went to Big Lonely Doug and filmed it, you know, for this project. And I have to say, this is one of those areas where you know, motion picture film doesn't actually capture the effect of what it is. Because if you get close to Big Lonely Doug at the base of it and look up, it's hard to capture. It's hard to convey it, even with video and even with a drone that I was flying to try to capture the size of it. This thing is a living superstructure. It is massive. It is awe-inspiring. And this is what we regularly had, was massive trees of this size. You stand at the base of this, it's like standing at the base of a small apartment block building.
So before we move on, can you talk about a little more about the natural communities that spring up around these ancient forests? And I'm thinking of in the redwoods, I learned, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago that there are entire communities of salamanders and everybody else living in the crowns of these trees who will never touch the ground. They have lived up in the crown for, you know, for generations. And then also, you know, there are salmon, there are, can you just talk about the interrelationships between the trees and some of the non-tree members of the community?
It's mind-blowing when you think about it. And I mean, it's almost close to, it's not quite in many cases what you would see in a tropical rainforest, where because of the temperature you get, you know, possibly a higher degree of complexity and just number of species. But what you see in the temperate rainforest is totally staggering, from subsoil all the way up to the very crown of the trees, if you're talking with these salamanders. You know, what you have is an ancient ecosystem. And if you want to think of the ecosystem itself as a distinct organism, which it kind of is in a way, this is an organism that goes back to the retreat of the glaciers at the end of the last ice age. This is a 30,000-year-old integrated organism that we're still finding things about. I mean, you want to talk about the things that we know that are there. You know, we know there are species, for instance, of marine birds, the marbled murrelet, that doesn't build nests on the ground. It's never evolved to do that, because the marbled murrelet could always find little homes in the abundant mosses that grow on these trees that are fed by the moisture coming off of the ocean. So they just lay their eggs in little indentations in the moss. Of course, the marbled murrelets are threatened because they have no other ability. They've never learned. They don't know how to make nests. They just use moss in ancient trees. That's been their niche for as long as they have existed. You go down and you get to the bottom of the tree and you look at the ecosystem that is there. A lot of it, in many cases, is integrated, as you mentioned, with the once prolific, now much a shadow of their former selves, salmon runs that were there. You have all of the species of salmon in these areas, and the salmon were a source of bringing nitrogen up into the forests, of course, because they swim up there to spawn, lay their eggs, they die, bears eat them, bears drag them off. So you have an incredibly rich ancient ecosystem that's not only fed by moisture from the ocean, but is enriched with fertilizer from the ocean in the form of the salmon that is swimming up there and being brought up there. Now it gets more interesting. Start examining what's happening in the subsoil area. One of the things we've learned recently that I think has changed the way people view forest ecology on the level of how Einstein upended the world of physics when he came out with special relativity is the work of Suzanne Simard. And Suzanne Simard is was a forestry professor from, I think still is, at the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver. And on a hunch that there was something going on, that there's basically a nervous system that exists in forests, and some kind of signaling that she suspected that was going on between trees, between a set species of trees, and possibly between different species of trees. She set out to discover this and find out if it was real. And she did a series of experiments where she used radioisotope gases that she was able to track the movements of, and these gases would be taken up into the trees. And she was able to show that they were moving through fungal networks. They were going down to the roots of trees, and then they were moving through fungal networks and communicating to other trees. Trees were finding out ways to share resources, to signal to each other. It was much more complex than anybody had thought before. This is, you know, why I say this was almost an Einsteinian level of rethinking what's going on in forests. And basically what it showed was that for people who say, yeah, well, we clear cut these forests, but we replant them, so, you know, big deal, you get the trees back. Well, what Simard showed was actually you don't, at least not right away, at least not for many thousands of years, because we have this incredibly complex neural system in the subsoil that we know is there now. And we still don't know everything about it. So how much is there about what is going on in the complexity of a forest like the coastal temperate rainforest that we still don't even know, that we still haven't even discovered yet? This was a staggering discovery. and it's going on in every forest. Trees are talking to each other. I mean, this is a stunning thing to think about. They have an awareness. They have a nervous system.
So before we talk about your film itself, I want to sort of echo something you said about, you know, it can take thousands of years for those fungal networks to grow. That I remember, 1989 or something, I was interviewing Richard Manning about forests, and I had this offhand comment in the middle of the interview where I said, gosh, you know, I wish we could, like, just set aside land, and then in 500 years, you'll have an old-growth forest, or you'll have the beginnings of an old-growth forest. And he said something that just blew me away, which is, Derek, a lot of these trees live to be 1,500 years or 1,000 years. So if you, in 500 years, you've not even gone halfway or a quarter way through the carbon cycle, because the carbon has to, I mean, the tree itself would live for 1,000 years, and then it falls over, and it can take another 200 years for it to decay. And so for a fully, you know, I've lived in timber country my entire adult life, and I say that sorrowfully, that, you know, they'll talk about, oh, trees just grow back like weeds, but the relationships, these are actually really old relationships. I'm wondering, you know, you just said that. Can you talk about the time, you know, I don't even know what I'm asking. Do you just take this anywhere?
Well, I mean, the time scale of the coastal temperate rainforest in some of the places that this film was shot in, namely the west coast of Vancouver Island and the Sunshine Coast north of Vancouver, particularly the Sunshine Coast north of Vancouver, which was at a higher elevation and where you see the yellow cedar dominated forest growing. Those trees grow to be some of the oldest trees in Canada. Now, just as a single individual living tree itself, it's not uncommon to find ones up there that are 2,000 years old. But when you think about that ecosystem itself, it has been in place, growing, building its complexity, basically since the retreat of the glaciers in the last ice age, so 30,000 years ago. So, you know, we're now, I think, despite what you think about industrial logging or clear cutting or whatever your view is, I mean, I think it's pretty much accepted that these forests are holistic entities unto themselves. They're almost like a superorganism. And if you think about it that way, which I don't think is a radical thought that is in dispute, this is a superorganism that goes back, that is 30,000 years old. So the time scales that we've been thinking about, for instance, we will clear cut this area here, we'll replant within 2 years, and then within 70 to 80 years, we'll have another crop of trees ready to go. And it's all good because they've been sequestering carbon and they'll provide more jobs. This really shows a lack of understanding or perhaps just not wanting to recognize the complexity of what was once there. You can't get an ancient old growth forest back in under 10,000 years after you cut it down. I think any ecologist and really any honest forester would admit that. You can't get the complexity. We don't even know the complexity of systems that have evolved for that many thousands of years. Now, it's unique more to this, and this is why I find the coastal temperate rainforest so intriguing, is because you've got the climactic conditions that allow for the kind of stupendous growth, and you also have this situation where in most cases, particularly the sort of mid to higher elevations, a lack of land clearing forest fires. So you get incredibly old, strange, complex, and beautiful things that are there that we are only beginning to understand.
So I have 1.5 questions before we go to your film. And the one question is, I'm just really curious. I'm really worried that where I live, in the past 20 years, I've gone from, or it has gone from, my mother killing lots of banana slugs in her garden, and there being, I have to, when I would take a wheelbarrow down a path, I would pull the wheelbarrow instead of push it because I didn't want to step on them. So I couldn't see. I would roll the wheel over them if I was, there were so many that I changed how I did a wheelbarrow for the banana slugs. And the past few years I've been seeing, like, these days it is a big deal if even during the rainiest season or during the dry season, I see three banana slugs in a day. That's a huge deal. And I'm terrified to even ask this question, but do you, anecdotally, do you see as many banana slugs as you used to?
Actually, I grew up like you in the coastal temperate rainforest. I grew up south of Vancouver. I would say, yeah, there were. It probably was the case that there were a lot more slugs when I was a kid than now. I mean, so this is 45 years ago. And what was going on 45 years ago? I was growing up in a kind of an ex-urban area. We were kind of a suburb, but kind of in a lot of undeveloped land. But there was a ton of more forested areas around than there are now. And what exactly is going on? Is there some disease that we don't know about? Is it just habitat loss? I would suspect. I mean, that generally seems to be the thing that's affecting our the species lost here in this region, from salmon to slugs, if that's going on, to different kinds of birds, is habitat loss as we cut down the forests. And as we cut down what we're only now learning is an ancient and incredibly complex organism, a super organism. And we don't know. I mean, banana slugs could be a telltale sign species.
I said I had 1.5 questions. The half a question is, do you want to talk about your film now, or do you want to talk about the scope of what has happened to the forests over the last 200 years, or do you want to combine those?
Why don't we combine them? And I'm just sort of happy to riff off of your curiosity and your next question and what you would like to know. So let's just keep this going, and I'm happy to talk about either.
Okay. Well, let's go first with, can you give a quick overview of the scope of what has happened to specifically temperate rainforests and specifically the rainforest you know best up there over the last 200 years?
I'm a guy who was originally from British Columbia, Canada, and spent a lot of time in the United States, and have obviously been paying attention to conservation issues and forestry issues for a long time. Both as someone who's just interested in it, and as a journalist. Though I am not what you would call an environmental journalist, I've done a lot of different kinds of projects, and I'm interested in a lot of things. This struck me as an important story. And as much as people who live in California, Oregon, Washington have been concerned and alarmed about the state of the forests, particularly the coastal forests there, there has been a big disconnect between what has been going on there and what has been happening in British Columbia. Maybe disconnect is the wrong word, just a lack of knowledge about it. And there are a lot of reasons for that. British Columbia is still a relatively unpopulated place. There's only about 5 million people now who live in British Columbia. Area-wise, it's the size of about 2 Californias. I hope I got that right. So it's a vast place. And British Columbia had massive forest resources. at the time of European contact, when Captain Cook, Captain Vancouver, and the Spaniards before them, who were actually the first Europeans to sail up this coast, saw these trees, they were gobsmacked by the size and the scope of the forests here. And I'm sure they had a similar sense of that too in the United States. But in British Columbia, everything was basically times 10. And from the early part of the province's history, resource policy management, particularly when it came to forestry, which has been British Columbia's single biggest sector and still is, the policy was basically, this is an unlimited supply. These forests are unlimited. We can cut and we can take as much as we want for as long as we want with fairly minimal management. Certainly not management that would be injurious in any way to the bottom lines of the companies that would get these concessions. Now, BC being so big, obviously the coastal temperate rainforest is just one part of it. I mean, it's even not the biggest part of the forests. If you go into the interior of British Columbia, like you have in Northern California, you get across the other side of the coastal mountains, you get into ponderosa pine and pine forests. But in BC, you go further north, you get a vast spruce-dominated forest that extends basically from north of the city of Kamloops up to Prince George, almost to the border with the Yukon Territory, where you get the boreal forest happening. And there are other mixed types of forests in there. There's actually a small fragment of temperate rainforest that is in the interior of British Columbia, which is very intriguing and quite unknown. But the scope of the forests were so huge that it was basically a free-for-all for a very long time. And the coastal forests offered some of the most valuable timber because of the size of the trees that you could get here. Up until recently, and even still to this day, there's the odd one that they take out, although not very much anymore. But up until the 50s, there was many times that they would go into some of the coastal valleys on Vancouver Island and up and down the coast where the very biggest trees were. And these trees were so big that you would cut them down and you would haul one single tree out on a logging truck. If you can picture in your mind's eye, you know, a logging truck, usually you see, you know, it's got a, you know, it's got the truck portion and then the trailer is basically two sort of open bins, and then they stack all of the logs in there. And you might see, you know, 20 to 40 logs, depending on the size of the logs. Well, up until, you know, really into the 70s, a very regular occurrence would be a truck coming out hauling just one single tree because that tree and the size of its diameter was so big. So think about the economic potential of this. And it was exploited. And some of the world's most successful, wealthiest timber companies made their money here in British Columbia. A lot of them are still here. A lot of them have changed names and are owned by successor companies. But clear-cutting these forests became by far the biggest business in British Columbia. And being a small, fairly sparsely populated province in Western Canada, I think the extent to what was going on in BC was not known to the rest of the world. After the 1970s, when conservation movements really sort of began to gain steam, when you saw Greenpeace starting up, which actually started in Vancouver for reasons totally different from forestry, but it actually started in Vancouver. You started seeing people paying attention to what was going on in British Columbia. And very slowly, the realization has been, whoa, wait. We're saying all of these things and we're talking at international conferences and we're very worried about the Amazon rainforest and other places. But what's been going on in British Columbia is actually way worse. And I say worse when I mean their concerns for the effects of industrial clear cutting and logging. If you're listening to this and you really want to get a sense, and this will make you sad probably if you do this, but just do a Google Maps flyover of British Columbia. Go to Google Maps, click the satellite option so you can, you know, actually see the pictures from space, and start to zero in just on the middle of Vancouver Island. Take a look at this checkerboard that you see. And you'll basically see there are hardly any parts of Vancouver Island, which was really the heart of the coastal temperate rainforest in North America. There are no parts that have not been logged, not been clear cut, not been stripped clean. And that view is actually a little bit misleading because they've replanted many of those blocks. So they appear from the satellite that there is a forest there, but it's not an original ancient forest. So you can do the same thing in the interior of British Columbia. If you want to do this, zoom in on an area near Williams Lake in British Columbia and just to the west of Williams Lake, and you'll see a checkerboard. You will not see anymore any vast areas of pristine, untouched forest. It has been massively logged on an industrial scale now for 75 years. And we're now seeing the consequences of this. And so you want to ask what's left. Now, the numbers are obviously very disputed because, of course, this is very political in a place like British Columbia, where the forest industry has been for a long time one of the single most powerful entities here. And they hire PR people and they commission their own studies and they have their own professors who, you know, give numbers about the state of the forest. But as a general rule, the conservationists like those from the Sierra Club, who I think you would agree are not the most radical of those in the conservation movement, they say we've got about 3% of the original old growth left on a place like Vancouver Island. So 97%. Has been logged already. Now, industry disputes that. They say it's actually higher than that, but they're not saying it's 10% left. So we're now down to, let's ballpark this out, between 3% and 10% of the original ancient forest left in coastal British Columbia. Certainly, now within that, the most stupendous, the best parts, the biggest trees are long gone. And that's where we're at now. And at this point in time, and this was part of the inspiration to do this film, industrial clear-cut logging of the ancient coastal forest is still going on big time. It's still a major business. And the province right now and the people are grappling with what to do. And it's a really big fight.
So before one more question now before we go to your film, and we have about 10 minutes left, that when we say there's 3% left, it's actually a little bit less because, or if it's 5%, whatever number it actually is, it's slightly less because of the edge effect and how temperatures, for example, won't stabilize inside of anybody who has ever been in the forest and walked from a forest into a meadow knows that on a sunny day, the temperature goes up 10 degrees, 15 degrees immediately. And yes. If you actually are being very sensitive, as many creatures are very sensitive, both with moisture, temperature, wind movement, everything else, it can take like up to 50 yards, 100 yards into the interior of a forest before you get to where it is under that entire comforting blanket. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt it myself many times, yes.
And so the point is, when we talk about 3% left, actually those 3%, I was thinking about this with Big Lonely Doug too, that, yeah, it's great that tree is alive, but that tree is now no longer surrounded by, it's no longer in habitat.
No, absolutely not. I mean, which which visually creates this heartbreaking scene that you see in the film. But it raises questions. How much longer will Big Lonely Doug survive, given that it's essentially in what would be a desert compared to what Big Lonely Doug is designed to grow in?
So let's finally move to the film. And I would like for you to talk about a couple things. The film itself, and to get people to watch your wonderful film, and also to, you know, out of all these years, like 95% of the interviews that I've done have been about my activism. And I've really enjoyed when people have also asked me, like I've done 5%, like 5 interviews or 50 interviews or 20 interviews over the years where I've been interviewed as a writer. So can you both talk about the film itself and also spend a couple minutes, reveling in the joy of filmmaking? And you can do those whichever order you want.
Sure. I'd love to do that. And it all goes together in this project. And when I got interested in this through contacts I'd made in Vancouver who were talking about these alarming numbers. And, you know, I was curious. I could see what they were doing. And there's an urgency that you can get when you say we're down to 3% or 5% or the last of this or the right. But my gut hunch was to really make this issue connect, it's necessary to capture the grandeur, the splendor, the sublime quality of ancient forests as much as you can. Because I felt like that's the thing that people are going to connect with. That will be, I mean, there are those who go up into them and have their own connection, but most people don't. And not because they're for cutting the forests down, but their lives are busy. They're living their lives. They know these forests exist and they've heard some of these numbers, but how will people have an emotional reaction to the state of the forests in either direction on them? And it's got to be through somehow connecting with it. So I set out to make this film and to include a lot of the activism that surrounds it, obviously, because those are some of the most passionate voices. And these are the people who were willing to talk about their personal and emotional connection to trees, which I find very fascinating as someone who spends a long time listening to talks by people like you and Terrence McKenna. So I decided that this will be mostly about the trees, and most of this will be sound, rich pictures, rich immersive imagery of forests. And so I used equipment that would enable me to do that, which included flying a drone and doing a lot of additional audio production in this, which I probably wouldn't have done in some of my other projects. And what I mean is, you know, going out and spending long periods of time in these forests with sensitive microphones and just capturing the ambient sounds of them to marry to these pictures and to really try to give people as best I can with the resources I had available the sense of what it's like to be in an ancient forest. And my hunch was this would be a powerful thing because, you know, I've been following the debate about logging in British Columbia and, you know, cutting down ancient trees and for a long time. And I actually feel that there's an optimistic way that you can feel right now. And, you know, what's lost is lost and what's gone is gone. And, you know, we need to feel sadness for what we've lost, but what I find now is I think more than ever, people who are sort of in the middle of the political spectrum, who are not activists, who have never been part of a march or a blockade or something. I find when I talk to average people like that, you know, for instance, when I was making this film, they would say, Paul, what are you doing? And I'd say, hey, I'm going up here to this ridge here because there's ancient trees up there, and there are people who want to protect them because they're actually in a cut block and they could be cut down. And they would say, what? What are you talking about? I thought these were protected now. Like, I thought all of this stuff got protected, like, I don't know, 20 years ago or something. And I'm actually, no, it hasn't been. And they were appalled. I mean, pretty much everybody who I would talk to would say something like that. And my hunch is, and I guess this is me coming at this story from sort of a mainstream news media perspective, because I, you know, relate and I talk to, you know, people who are in the middle, not just in the activist community, that if you tell them we have trees that are 2,000 years old and they're not protected and they can be cut down to make lumber and it will provide some jobs for some people now, but obviously when they're gone, they're gone. More than ever, people say, no way, that needs to stop. That can't happen. And these are people who don't go up into the forests and have yet to experience it. They just, so, I mean, because, you know, there still is something that is primal and is deep and is archetypal within us that is blown away by forests. And we still have that in us. So my hope was, you know, you talk about the making of the films, the painstaking sort of persnickety thing about getting all of the technical things right. The beauty of that is if you work at it long enough, you might get some really beautiful images that move people. And I've had some feedback from the film and people who said, yeah, like, this is fucking amazing. This is in our backyard and it's totally underrated. And it sort of leads me to this, I don't know if it's a talking point or kind of a heuristic or a sort of a simple folky kind of philosophy, but we've got these incredible ancient superstructures like Big Lonely Doug and many others that are actually still in relatively intact forests, and they're ancient. They belong to us all. And why aren't we viewing these in the same way that the Egyptians view their pyramids, or India views the Taj Mahal, or Europeans view their Gothic cathedrals? Like, there's no way a businessman could come and say, hey, man, we're going to knock down the Taj Mahal and sell the bricks. Like, you could probably make money doing that. You could create jobs doing that. But that's off limits because this is considered a sacred part of history. These are incredible megastructures. And why aren't we, or is it possible maybe we are starting to see these forests as ancient structures to be preserved for their own sake, in the same way that nobody would think about taking a wrecking ball to the pyramids? I mean, I'm curious, do you think that's possible at this point?
It's a really good question. And I want to say yes, and then, but actions speak louder than words, and I still see it happening. So I don't know how to respond. I mean, I love it. I love the comparison you're making. And a comparison Thomas Berry used to make was that it'd be like taking the Mona Lisa and putting it in your fireplace because you're a little tiny bit cold. And
precisely.
And so I love that image. I just don't know the answer to your question. I think it's a hugely important question we all need to ask. I just don't know the answer.
I mean, one thing that's changing, and this was part of why I wanted to make Last of the Ancient Rainforest, was that in British Columbia, and I assume the same thing has been true in the areas of Washington, Oregon, and California, where there has been industrial forestry happening, is they've had a very powerful argument, and it's been much more powerful in BC, I think, than anywhere else in North America. Jobs, jobs, jobs is what the industry has always said. This is about jobs. This is about good paying jobs that support a family. And there's something to that. I mean, we have to take that into account. But these days, and I think this is part of why I'm sensing there could be a turning point in British Columbia, the number of jobs is at a historic low water mark. there's fewer jobs in forestry than ever. There's fewer jobs in the sawmills because British Columbia is exporting more raw logs overseas than ever before. There's fewer jobs in the pulp and paper mills because they've automated so much. And there's fewer jobs in logging also because they've automated as well, to the extent that they can. And I mean, this is, we have, so as there's fewer jobs, I mean, the intensity of the argument that we need to cut these trees down because this is our livelihood, it kind of, it's diminishing. How many jobs? Where are the people? The jobs are going away, and they're certainly going away once the forests are gone. And as automation continues, I mean, and it also, I think people are also starting to recognize that the jobs argument is spin, because, you know, a company doesn't do any activity in order to create jobs, right? Jobs are the thing that gets minimized and reduced if possible. Why does a company do anything? It's profits. So if they're being honest, they should be saying, we need to cut down the last of the ancient rainforest for profit. That's the reason why they're doing it. And I think people are more onto that than they used to be. And they don't buy the spin as much. I could be wrong about that.
Well, I hope so, because I know, like, through the 80s, when it was all the mainstream press was crying, it's jobs versus owls, the actual cut was going up. And the jobs were going down, but not because of owls at all, because, like I said, the cut was going up. The jobs were going down because of raw log exports and automation, both of which you just discussed a moment ago. And I'm hoping that argument is wearing thin 40 years later.
I kind of sense anecdotally it is, just from the conversations I have. And when I say conversations I have, like, I'm talking to, like, the guys who work behind the counter at the Canadian Tire store. You might not know what that means if you're in the United States, but it's sort of like a Pet Boys, an automotive place that's ubiquitous up in Canada. And I've had conversations with guys in Canadian Tires as I was doing this film and getting my tires fixed. And what are you doing up here? And I tell them, and they like, yeah, we're losing the forest, and where are the jobs? And I think that this could possibly be starting to sink in to people. And the old PR, the old spin, is not as effective anymore.
Well, thank you for saying that, because I think that the auto tire shop conversation is more important in gauging public perception than two environmentalists sitting around talking. From now on, thank you for that. I'm going to use the auto shop waiting room metric for, and I'm not making a joke at all, the auto shop waiting room metric for public opinion.
Well, I think that's I really believe that is worth something too. And I've seen this, and I've obviously covered it, you know, conservationists and environmentalists and in many different phases of the work that they're doing. And these changes to things like our stewardship of the coastal rainforest, big changes are not going to happen through things like the already mobilized activists cranking up their intensity, you know, by 100%. They're going to be won by getting the people in that vast middle to care 5% more.
Right. So, which actually brings us, we're running out of time. And so sorry to be so crass, make an explicit pitch for people to watch your film, and also tell them how they can do it.
Okay, wow. Yeah, we all struggle with this, don't we, making the pitch. So the film is called Last of the Ancient Rainforest, and it is launched worldwide and is available as a download that you can buy or rent on Vimeo.com, which in my experience is a great platform that is reliable and high quality. soon coming to some other streamers and broadcasters to be announced in the coming months. I think it's safe to say if you know about IndieFlix, you'll be able to see it there soon. But Vimeo.com, Last of the Ancient Rainforest. I hope you enjoy it. And, you know, the one thing I would say about the film, editorially, whether you're moved by what the people in it are saying or not, if you haven't been able to take a walk in the woods, I think the film will kind of help get you there. Obviously can't replace it, but it's an immersive journey into one of the most extraordinary forests in the world.
Well, thank you so much for all that, and thank you for making the film, which I have seen and is, I have to say, utterly fantastic. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Paul Johnson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.